You're listening to the podcast Surgery ICU Rounds. My name's Dr. Jeffrey Guy. I'm an associate professor of surgery at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee, and I am the director of the burn center there. Today, the topic that I would like to talk about is that of abdominal compartment syndrome. Abdominal compartment syndrome is the presence of elevated intra-abdominal pressures, and it's been commonly recognized as a factor contributing to the morbidity and mortality of the critically ill and injured patient for quite some time. The actual syndrome of abdominal compartment syndrome really occurs when the increased intra-abdominal pressure or the intra-abdominal hypertension develops to the point where it causes physiological embarrassment of several of vital organs. For instance, decreased cardiac return resulting in poor cardiac output, hypotension, respiratory embarrassment, and renal failure. It would appear that increased intra-abdominal pressure is perhaps more common than many of us may have thought. Epidemiological studies have found that in the critically ill patients, the prevalence of increased intra-abdominal pressure or increased abdominal hypertension occurs between 2 and 33% of patients. How do we really define an increase in intra-abdominal pressure? Well, it's really defined as a intra-abdominal pressure greater than 20 millimeters of mercury. And abdominal compartment syndrome, therefore, is defined as having increased intra-abdominal pressure, that is, a intra-abdominal pressure greater than 20 millimeters of mercury, and one or more organs that have failed because of that increased intra-abdominal pressure. It's that second element, that end organ dysfunction, that's important, because what happens is that people start getting into the notion of good number, bad number. Now we have these Foley catheters that are on the market that you can transduce to an arterial line setup on your monitor, and you can actually measure continuously intra-abdominal pressure. And what that does is it puts people into the mindset that I have a good number and a bad number, and that a number greater than 20 is always bad, and a number always less than 20 is always good. And we're going to go through and define that that's not particularly the case. If you have an intra-abdominal pressure of 25 or even 30, but you have no respiratory embarrassment, no cardiovascular compromise, and adequate urine output, is that somebody who you would define as abdominal compartment syndrome or that you would need to do something about? And the answer is no, you don't need to intervene on that patient. You certainly need to monitor that patient, but you wouldn't say that patient has abdominal compartment syndrome. Well, what is the intra-abdominal pressure? And that would seem to be reasonably obvious, but that's the pressure concealed with the abdominal cavity. And it's really determined by a couple of factors. And this seems reasonably obvious, but when you approach these patients in the intensive care unit, it always helps if you break it down and try to evaluate what are the potential problems here. Well, what are the three factors? The first is the abdominal organ volume, okay? How much are my viscera taking up? How have my things like my liver, my spleen, my colon, and small bowel. The next thing is the presence of space-occupying substances, and this could include things such as blood, ascites, other types of fluid, air, or tumor mass. And the third is the abdominal wall compliance. Okay, now let's think about that for a second. We have our normal organs, we have things inside the abdomen which aren't our normal organs, blood, fluid, ascites, and then we have the abdominal wall compliance. Now, abdominal wall compliance really is how elastic and compliance have a mathematical relationship my abdomen is. Well, what can change, for instance, my abdominal wall compliance? Well, one could be things such as the mass, whether somebody has a large pannus, somebody leaning on their abdomen. We see this a lot, or leaning on chest, particularly in the operating room. Anesthesia will kindly remind the resident of the medical student not to lean on the chest, but also fluid resuscitation. If somebody's getting a lot of fluid and they have a lot of abdominal wall edema, that's going to decrease the abdominal wall compliance. And that can certainly contribute to the development of an increased intra-abdominal pressure, because what happens as viscera will swell, as there's increased blood or ascites, the abdomen will begin to distend. But if the abdomen can't distend as easily because of decreased compliance, you're going to see a more rapid increase in pressure. Other things that could do it, particularly in the patients that I care for on a routine and daily basis, are burns. If you have a burn to your abdominal wall, the Tissue gets very leathery and it actually will contract and produce really marked reduction in the abdominal wall compliance. Now, we've talked before and in previous podcasts about things about escharotomies and circumferential burns, but here's a situation where by even scoring a third-degree burn of the abdomen, we're going to improve abdominal wall compliance, and that can certainly help with abrogating or reducing the likelihood of having something like increased abdominal pressures or abdominal compartment syndrome. The normal adult intra-abdominal pressure is typically less than 5 millimeters of mercury, but this can be non-pathologically increased, particularly in the obese adult. Intra-abdominal pressure in the typical post-laparotomy patient is between 5 and 15. So again, even the routine patient coming in with a colectomy, what have you, will have some element of increased intra-abdominal pressure. In the critically ill patient, who is systematically hypoperfused and within shock, the intra-abdominal pressure can be between 15 and 20, and this is not an uncommon finding in the critically ill patient. And as we've said, elevation of the intra-abdominal pressure can result in physiological embarrassment of multiple organ systems, namely cardiac, pulmonary, renal, GI, hepatic, central nervous system, and certainly abdominal wall perfusion. And each organ system has its own vulnerabilities and how they will present. Let's take time for a small timeout. Welcome back. Let's get into what are the impairments by each organ system by having elevated intra-abdominal pressure. Let's look first at the effect of increased abdominal pressure on the cardiovascular system. And this is not something that is rather new, but what happens is rising intra-abdominal pressure increases the intrathoracic pressure by elevation of the diaphragm, and this increased intrathoracic pressure therefore reduces venous return. Okay, so what happens is you're putting pressure on the vena cava. Blood cannot return to the heart as well, and basically that does what? That reduces your preload, and that reduces your cardiac output. Furthermore, you see compression of both the aorta and the pulmonary parenchyma due to this increase in the diaphragm and compression of the pulmonary parenchyma, and that results in increases in systemic vascular resistance as well. Looking at the pulmonary system, and again, you have to think, if you're inflating the abdomen with a fluid or edema or air, that diaphragm is going to go in a cephalad direction, and that again is going to put increase in intrathoracic pressure through the elevation of the diaphragm. And as we just mentioned, what this does is this actually puts compression or squeezes the lung parenchyma, and that will result in problems like atelectasis, decrease in diffusion capacity and carbon dioxide diffusion capacity across the alveolar capillary membrane. So you're going to have a problem with oxygenation as well as getting rid of carbon dioxide, as well as increase in problems with a shunt and alveolar dead space. And these kind of dysfunctions can be seen as with intra-abdominal pressures as low as 15 millimeters of mercury. And this will be aggravated in the case of hypovolemia. We're going to talk about this a little bit later on, is again, we don't want to get into that good number or bad number, because the overall physiological status of the patient can make these systems more aggravated. So if you have somebody who's hypotensive and an elevated intra-abdominal pressure, certainly compression on the lung parenchyma and the vena cava are going to be more pronounced, even though when you're kind of in the okay zone by looking at just the numbers of intra-abdominal pressure. One of the earlier signs that we see, let's go back on talking about the pulmonary system. What happens if you've got somebody on a mechanical ventilator and they're developing intra-abdominal compartment syndrome? We're talking that they're having problems with diffusion. We're going to see perhaps decreases in their oxygen saturation or their PO2. Their PCO2 may rise. But also what you're going to see is you see a decreased compliance, not only of the abdomen, but also of the thoracic bellow system. And we've talked about this in other podcasts about what is peak inspiratory pressure. There's a lot of emphasis on peak inspiratory pressure nowadays, and particularly in the management of ARDS, but we focus a lot on this. And peak inspiratory pressure, there's an equation for this, and the peak inspiratory pressure is defined by the equation, and I can't write this down for you to look at, but it's the tidal volume over the compliance of the lung and the thorax. That product, that dividend, added to the product of the resistance of the airways and the flow of the gas. But let's take the first part of that equation, tidal volume over the compliance of the lung and the thorax. So at a given tidal volume, as the the compliance of the thorax decreases, the peak inspiratory pressure is going to go up. And what's going to decrease the thoracic compliance? Well, the diaphragm being pushed in a cephalad direction by increasing abdominal pressure is going to drop your thoracic compliance. Therefore, at a given set tidal volume on your mechanical ventilator, you're going to see elevations of your peak inspiratory pressure. And that's going to be a manifestation you're going to see on your ventilators and certainly can aggravate some of the problems in a critically ill patient. Now, looking at the renal system, low urine output is one of the earliest signs that we see with intra-abdominal hypertension and abdominal compartment syndrome. Well, why is this? Well, as the abdominal pressure increases, the renal artery blood flow decreases, and you see compression of the renal vein. So what happens is you see renal dysfunction and failure. Even if the mean pressure in the renal artery decreases, or excuse me, it stays the same, say the mean arterial pressure in the renal artery is 65, and prior to the development of intra-abdominal pressure, the patient has a central venous pressure of 5. Okay, so 65, 5. The difference there is 60. And blood flows by the gradient, so your differential in pressure there is roughly 60 millimeters of mercury. So if you think about a truck rolling downhill, there's your gradient, 60. Now, let's keep the mean arterial pressure in that renal artery the same, just for the sake of this discussion. And we increase the abdominal pressure. And if you've never seen a renal vein or a vena cava, it's very, very thin, very easily to compress with extrinsic compression versus an artery. An artery, you can still compress, but there's much more substance to an artery, less likely to compress. And the pressure pushing back on an artery is much higher. You think about, you know, somebody's got a pressure of 120 over 80, you've got to overcome that pressure to occlude that vessel. Now, let's take our patient who still has a mean pressure in that renal artery of 65 millimeters of mercury, we increase the intra-abdominal pressure, say, up to 20. That is going to push on that renal vein. So now the CVP, the pressure inside that renal vein, is now 20. So your difference there is 65 minus 20 is, what, 45. Versus the 60 we had before the development of intra-abdominal pressure. So again, you think about your truck rolling down the hill, that's a less steep of a hill. That will decrease renal blood flow. And therefore, that is the initiation of how we can see problems with the development of increased intra-abdominal pressure. Now, oliguria can develop, or low urine output, can develop with an intra-abdominal pressure of 15 millimeters of mercury. And we could see total anuria, absence of any urine output, at a pressure of 30 millimeters of mercury. That is if the patient is normal volemic. Now, diminished renal perfusion pressure and the renal filtration gradient have been proposed as key factors in the development of intra-abdominal pressure-induced renal failure. Now, what is a filtration gradient? Now, that's the mechanical force across the glomerulus and equals the difference between the glomerular filtration pressure and the proximal tubule pressure. Now, what is that? Now, remember how the kidney works. You have the glomerulus, which the blood vessels flow into, and they have a certain pressure, and fluid is pushed out through the glomerulus into the proximal tubule of the nephron. Okay, and again, much like that kidney, things have to flow from a system of high pressure to low pressure. Therefore, your filtration gradient is defined as your glomerular filtration pressure minus your proximal tubule pressure. Now, in the absence of intra-abdominal pressure, this proximal tubule pressure is basically the same as your intra-abdominal pressure. And therefore, your glomerular filtration pressure is really defined as your mean arterial pressure minus your intra-abdominal pressure, much like we said earlier. Filtration gradient can be calculated really by the formula of mean arterial pressure minus twice your intra-abdominal pressure. So from that equation, it's pretty obvious that changes in the intra-abdominal pressure have a really greater impact on renal function and urine production than changes in the mean arterial pressure when you have an elevation of your intra-abdominal pressure. Now let's focus on the impact of increased intra-abdominal pressure on the GI system. And what you have to think about there is what, as we compress the bowel and the mesentery of the bowel, what is that doing to the viability and the health of the small bowel as well as the colon? And the most obvious there is a reduction of mesenteric blood flow. And this can appear with intra-abdominal pressures as low as 10 millimeters of mercury. The celiac artery blood flow can be reduced by up to 43%, and the superior mesenteric artery blood flow can be reduced by as much as 69% in the presence of intra-abdominal pressures of about 40 millimeters of mercury. The negative effect of intra-abdominal pressure on mesenteric perfusion are augmented by the presence of hypovolemia and hemorrhage. Okay, so that seems to be reasonably obvious, and this is why I want to get away from a bad number, good number type added, effect, because if you are increasing your abdominal pressure and you have a patient who's already hypovolemic or from loss of fluids, burn patient, hemorrhage from a trauma patient, what have you, the impact of the intra-abdominal pressure on bowel ischemia or bowel blood flow is going to be, the impact is going to be greater in the hypovolemic patient than the resuscitated euvolemic patient. An increase intra-abdominal pressure of 20 millimeters of mercury can decrease intestinal mucosa perfusion and has been speculated to be a possible mechanism for the subsequent development of bacterial translocation, sepsis, multi-organ failure. Bacterial translocation of the mesenteric lymph nodes has been demonstrated to occur in the presence of hemorrhage with intra-abdominal pressures as low as 10 millimeters of mercury. So what we're saying here is that as we increase the intra-abdominal pressures as low as 10, what that does is that decreases the renal blood, that decreases perfusion to the bowel and may aggravate bacterial translocation. Well, why is that important? Why is that relevant here? Well, when you have bacterial translocation, the bacteria basically translocate and they go to the mesenteric lymph nodes. And this has been well studied and well demonstrated and well published that when you get bacterial translocation to the mesenteric lymph nodes, you basically, those lymph nodes begin to get angry and they produce things like pro-inflammatory cytokines, TNF-alpha, interleukin-2, interleukin-6, and so forth. And that creates a surge response. Well, when somebody has a surge response, what do? They vasodilate, they get hypotensive, and what do? We give them more fluid. What does that do to our intra-abdominal pressure? What does that do to our visceral edema? Well, the visceral edema will probably get worse because we're giving them more volume. What does that do to our intra-abdominal pressure? That increases it. What does that do to our mesenteric blood flow? That'll decrease it. What does that do to our integrity of our mucosa, of our bowel? Decreases it. And then you get into this circle, like a dog chasing its tail. And this is called a positive feedback cycle. So you really have to not look at these things in silos, but you need to figure out how they're interrelated. So again, going down this pathway of elevated intra-abdominal pressures can get to be a rather slippery slope, and we can actually make our treatment worse than our disease if we're not very careful. Talking about the patient who has potential traumatic brain injury, what is the impact of elevated intra-abdominal pressures on the central nervous system? Well, cerebral perfusion and function can be affected directly by the presence of increased intra-abdominal pressure. Increased intrathoracic pressure really does impair venous return from the cranium, and that decreases cerebral venous blood flow. We talk a lot about intracranial pressures, but people are starting to look at in traumatic brain injury not only the pressures in the brain, but also the cerebral perfusion and the cerebral perfusion and blood flow in regards to oxygen delivery as well as mitochondrial viability. And as you increase intrathoracic pressures, you are going to decrease blood flow through the venous system, draining the brain. Therefore, elevations in intra-abdominal pressure will then increase what? Intrathoracic pressure. That's going to increase the pressure in the central veins, in the vena cava. That's going to result in a decrease in blood flow through the veins draining the brain and may result in increased pressures within the cranium and result in sustained reductions in cerebral perfusion pressures. Hypovolemia, which typically occurs in patients who may have intra-abdominal pressures, may worsen already marginal cerebral perfusion pressures. Looking at the abdominal wall, we said with the three factors that contribute to the physiology of abdominal compartment syndrome are abdominal organ volume, how big are my viscera, and I mean my intra-abdominal viscera, my liver swollen, my bowels, and so forth. What is the space occupying lesion, blood or fluid or whatever? But then we go back to abdominal wall compliance. Now we're going to focus on a little bit on that abdominal wall. Visceral edema, such as it may occur with large resuscitations, decrease in abdominal wall compliance, that may occur with burns, abdominal packs, intraperitoneal fluid, bowel distension of the abdomen. Those can all affect this. Abdominal wall edema secondary to shock and fluid resuscitation will decrease the abdominal compliance, and therefore that's going to aggravate an already increased abdominal pressure, and that's going to reduce the blood flow to the abdominal wall as well. Rectus sheath blood flow can be decreased by almost 58% of baseline at an intra-abdominal pressure as low as 10 millimeters of mercury and to 20 millimeters of baseline at 40 millimeters of mercury. Why is that relevant? Why are we looking at rectus blood flow with increases in intra-abdominal pressure? Well, that's going to result in impaired wound healing, because wound healing does depend on blood flow. And therefore, when you have patients who have elevated intra-abdominal pressures, there's a high rate of fascial dehiscence and predilection for the development of necrotizing fasciitis. This is clearly identified in patients whose abdomens are closed under tension in the cases of intra-abdominal hypertension. As a result of significant variations that exist in patient physiology, a single threshold value of intra-abdominal pressure cannot be applied to global decision-making about all critically ill patients. This is what we're trying to avoid, is this idea of a good number, bad number. Intra-abdominal pressures lack sufficient sensitivity and specificity at clinically appropriate thresholds of 10 to 25 millimeters of mercury to be really useful as resuscitation endpoints. This is why, at least in my simple brain, I don't understand the real value of having a Foley catheter that can serially, continuously measure intra-abdominal pressures, because what we need to look at are all the other physiological variables that we've already discussed. Is the patient making urine? Is the patient's peak inspiratory pressures okay? Is the elevation of intra-abdominal pressure impairing cardiac return and therefore cardiac output? So we really want to avoid that good number, bad number idea. Attempts to improve the sensitivity of intra-abdominal pressure have led to its use in the calculation assessment of something called a abdominal perfusion pressure as a more sensitive predictor of illness and resuscitation. So we have to be kind of thinking about, what do we do in the case of someone who has a traumatic brain injury? Well, we use something called the cerebral perfusion pressure. We take the mean arterial pressure and look at the ICP, and then you could have somebody who has a low ICP but a low mean arterial pressure, and we say, well, that's probably not enough blood flow to give to the injured brain. Well, in this case, it's a similar type of idea using abdominal perfusion pressure, is that you take the mean arterial pressure minus the intra-abdominal pressure, and this may be a more sensitive marker to what's going on in the abdomen. Because again, somebody could have a hypotension, they could have a mean pressure in 40 and have an intra-abdominal pressure of, say, 10 or 20, and that's going to result in a low abdominal perfusion pressure. Abdominal perfusion pressure has been demonstrated to be superior to both intra-abdominal pressure and global resuscitation endpoints such as pH-based deficit, arterial lactate, and its ability to predict patient outcome. Let's take a small time out, and then when we come back, we'll talk about the presentation and diagnosis of patients with abdominal compartment syndrome. Welcome back. What we want to talk about now is when we should consider increased intra-abdominal pressure, intra-abdominal hypertension. And really, and any patient who presents with one or more of the following, we should really be kind of thinking about intra-abdominal hypertension. Anybody who has prolonged shock, such as acidosis, hypothermia, hemorrhage, coagulopathy. Anybody who's had visceral ischemia or perforation, traumatic injuries, obviously, sepsis, massive fluid resuscitation. And what's interesting is the number used is somebody who's had more than 5 liters of resuscitation in greater than 24 hours. I don't know how many patients I've seen have gotten 5 liters within an hour. Ruptured abdominal aneurysms, retroperitoneal hemorrhage, abdominal neoplasms, liver dysfunction, ascites, pancreatitis, burns, certainly, in ileus and patients who have gastroparesis. There are several grades of intra-abdominal hypertension, and that's defined by really intra-abdominal hypertension. If somebody has intra-abdominal pressure greater than 20 millimeters of mercury, or a abdominal perfusion pressure of less than 60 millimeters of mercury, really have early intra-abdominal hypertension. But the number that you may not be common to see is that abdominal perfusion pressure of 60 millimeters of mercury. Grade 1 intra-abdominal hypertension is those who have an IAP between 12 and 15, grade 2 if it's between 16 and 20, grade 3 is 21 to 25, and grade 4 is if you've got intra-abdominal pressure greater than 25 millimeters of mercury. It's kind of interesting to have these grading systems, but again, we want to be treating physiology and treating patients. We don't want to be treating one single number. Now, we said abdominal compartment syndrome is intra-abdominal hypertension with an end organ dysfunction. So dysfunction could be recognized untreated intra-abdominal hypertension, but it's defined by a sustained or repeated intra-abdominal pressure of greater than 20 millimeters of mercury and or an abdominal perfusion pressure of less than 60 millimeters of mercury in association with new onset single or multiple organ system failure. Abdominal compartment syndrome is not graded, but rather it's considered an all or nothing phenomena. Abdominal compartment syndrome is characterized clinically by one of the following: patients who have metabolic acidosis despite what appears to be ongoing inadequate resuscitation, oliguria despite volume depletion, elevated peak airway pressures, hypercarbia refractory to increased mechanical ventilation. And this is due to the issues we talked about elevation of the diaphragm resulting in shunt and an alveolar atelectasis, hypoxemia refractory to oxygen and positive end expiratory pressure, and certainly intracranial hypertension. Now, I would put all of this in a little bit of context when applying these to patients. Now, abdominal compartment syndrome may be characterized further by primary, secondary, or recurrent. Now, what's primary? Well, primary abdominal compartment syndrome develops due to conditions associated with abdominal pelvic regional injuries or diseases requiring emergent surgical or angiographic interventions such as damage control laparotomies, bleeding, pelvic fractures, retroperitoneal hematomas, failed non-operative management, or after elective abdominal surgery that may occur in cases of peritonitis or liver transplantation. Secondary abdominal compartment syndrome is really represents a complication of shock resuscitation or a robust shock resuscitation, and that leads to interstitial edema, the swelling of the organs, and it typically develops due to conditions outside the abdomen, and this can be such as sepsis, capillary leak syndrome, major burns, other conditions requiring massive fluid resuscitations. Now, recurrent abdominal compartment syndrome is really a second hit phenomena after the initial recovery from either secondary or primary abdominal compartment syndrome. Diagnosis: failure to identify the presence of abdominal compartment syndrome can be associated with mortality of up to 100%. I mean, if you're not able to ventilate a patient and their cardiac output is totally embarrassed and they're in cardiovascular collapse, that's pretty straightforward, and this can get rather dramatic. Clinical examination is notoriously poor at detecting intra-abdominal pressures, and therefore the presence of intra-abdominal hypertension or abdominal compartment syndrome may go unrecognized. Now, the recognition of the potentially lethal effects of elevated abdominal pressures has led to some of the widespread institution of intravascular bladder pressure measurements. And how this is done is, as I said, there are systems where you can, Foley catheter has a pressure transducer, and you can end up using continuous monitoring. I'm not exactly sure how you need to use continuous monitoring, but that's just perhaps more of my biases. But you can also measure bladder pressure by setting up an arterial line kit and then accessing the aspiration port of a Foley catheter. This will allow you, you infuse 50 milliliters of normal saline, this will allow you measure a pressure inside the abdomen, but you need to make sure that you zero it properly, which is going to be your pubic symphysis in this case, and you're consistent with the amount of fluid that you're inserting into the bladder, because again, you're going to have issues of compliance if you try to put too much or too little. Intra-abdominal pressure should be expressed in terms of millimeters of mercury, and 1 millimeter of mercury is equivalent to 1.3 centimeters of water, and measured at end expiration in a supine position after ensuring that the abdominal muscular contractions are absent with the transducer zeroed at the level we've mentioned it. Some people go mid-axillary line or the pubic symphysis, but perhaps the mid-axillary line may be more consistent with what you're using arterially. Serial determinations of intradominal pressure have shown to reliably detect the development of intradominal hypertension and to facilitate early treatment for the development of abdominal compartment syndrome with significant reductions in patient morbidity and mortality. Well, how do you treat it? This is something that really depends on where you're at. So you can certainly do some of the things we talked about to improve abdominal wall compliance or reduce some of the volume of the visceral contents, paracentesis if you're draining off ascites, gastric suctioning if you've got a large distended stomach, rectal enemas and suctioning to try to decrease some of the volume of the colon, sedation, and this will certainly help with the abdominal wall compliance, as would pharmacological paralysis. Body positioning as well, may taking some of the pressure off the diaphragm and improving the pulmonary compliance, and that may improve some of your peak inspiratory pressures. Gastroprokinetics, colon prokinetics, diuresis, and even things such as continued venous hemofiltration. Decompressive laparotomy still remains perhaps the mainstay in refractory abdominal compartment syndrome that can't be managed medically or certainly causing respiratory or cardiovascular embarrassment. And this results in basically evisceration of the patient, leaving a large midline wound, which in some cases is left open for days and days. And what the problem with this is this results in loss of anatomical domain of the abdominal viscera and patients who cannot be closed, certainly on the acute hospitalization. And then patients go to the operating room and have temporary or permanent closures using either absorbable mesh or attempted permanent closures using some of the biomaterials that are available, such as human acellular dermis or Surgisys or some of those other agents. So it is a, you may classify this as a potential complication of aggressive fluid resuscitation. Certainly, there are a subset of patients who require large volume resuscitations in order to survive their injuries. However, there are also subsets of patients who develop abdominal compartment syndrome who had a runaway resuscitation and perhaps did not need the magnitude of fluids that they need, and they end up suffering from this complication, which can be significant morbidity when you look at patients who have had their abdomens opened. They've had, as Tim Fabian has described in the literature, a planned, staged abdominal closure by putting absorbable mesh in and skin grafting that area. That allows for a large midline ventral hernia that then's closed about a year later. So the patient really is saddled with a debilitating, cosmetically horrible hernia for about a year from the results of a decompressive laparotomy for the treatment of abdominal compartment syndrome. You've been listening to the podcast, Surgery ICU Rounds. This is available on iTunes by searching ICU Rounds, or it can be caught through a direct download on the web at www.icurounds.com. My name is Jeff Guy, and thank you for downloading.